China is trying to snuff out Taiwan and make it seem to disappear from global view. Our trip does give Taiwan visibility.
Taiwan's president makes a brief visit to the United States. It's Tuesday, August 14th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China detains a VOA reporter. A half-century love affair with a Ford Mustang. Sustainable football and issues with a cashless society. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen is traveling to Paraguay and Belize this week, two of just 18 countries that continue to have diplomatic relations with Taipei. Before leaving Taiwan, she said her intention was to expand its diplomatic space, adding, as long as Taiwan remains firm, no one can obliterate its existence. She stopped in Los Angeles first and will visit Houston on her return. The trip comes amid tensions with mainland China, which considers the island to be part of China, and a trade dispute with the United States, which has sought close ties with Taipei since President Donald Trump entered office. Bill Sharp, a Taiwan scholar and host of the online program Asia in Review, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the mainland has won over more countries to break ties with Taiwan while demanding airlines and other businesses delete all references to Taiwan on their websites.
Chinese pressure is increasing bit by bit on her to accept the 92 consensus, which says that there's only one China and that Taiwan is part of that. But, you know, she's not buying into that. She's never said that she would from the day she was elected. She's always made it very clear that she would not accept that notion of the 92 consensus. China, I think, is getting very frustrated with Taiwan. I see it more and more all the time, and it's ratcheting up every kind of mechanism of pressure that it can think of to get Taiwan to accept the 92 consensus and to ultimately agree to unification.
The number of countries, Bill, now down to just 18 that recognize Taiwan's existence formally, diplomatically. What is the purpose of her trip? Is it more than just visiting two countries? Is there something larger at stake here?
She says it gives the world the visibility. China is trying to snuff out Taiwan and make it seem to disappear from global view. Her trip does give Taiwan visibility. It lets the world know that there is a Taiwan. It also lets the world know that Taiwan is a free and democratic society. It also helps to cement these relations with the remaining 18 allies. And that's crucially important to Taiwan because it gives itself some legitimacy as a sovereign nation.
In recent months, two countries, Panama and the Dominican Republic, have switched their allegiance from Taiwan to mainland China. One analyst in England said this: Beijing is gradually rolling out punitive measures across the entire spectrum of activity and interactions. Going after allies is high profile and rich in symbolism. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I agree with that quite strongly, actually.
Now, you know that foreign airlines have been under pressure to drop all references to Macau and to Taiwan by China. They seem to be going along with this. Is this inevitable at this point?
I understand there's still some airlines that have not acceded to this pressure. We'll see what happens in the future, whether they will ultimately or not.
Her trip comes just after the Taiwan state-run refiner CPC Corporation announcing a deal valued at $25 billion to purchase liquefied natural gas from the U.S. over the next 25 years. The deal aimed at boosting relations but also cutting Taiwan's trade surplus with the U.S. Is this targeting China?
This is designed to strengthen the relationship between the United States and Taiwan. The United States has long been very upset about trade deficits, especially under this administration. I think that this is a very clever move on the behalf of Taiwan. Taiwan knows that it needs to reduce a trade deficit with the United States. It also has no form of energy of its own. The U.S. has lots of natural gas. It's a great move.
During her U.S. stops, President Tsai was to meet with Taiwan Americans, visit the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and speak with American businessmen and talk with the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Republican Ed Royce. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll currently find on voanews.com. Death toll from earthquake near Indonesian island tops 430. blaze at Taiwan hospital kills 9, cause being investigated. Korean leaders to hold summit next month in Pyongyang. Inter-Korean tourism surge expected if peace prevails. China rescue vessel in disputed sea described as public relations move. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. And as always, you can stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Voice of America's Mandarin Service correspondent and a multimedia journalist working for VOA were detained late Monday by Chinese police while attempting to interview a retired Chinese professor who was taken away by authorities during a live television interview with VOA nearly 2 weeks ago. Correspondent Yibing Feng and VOA contractor Alan Ai were taken into custody in Jinan, Shandong province after talking to Professor Sun Wen Guang, 84 years old, through a closed door of his apartment. All have since been released. VOA Asia's Ira Melman joins us with more on the story.
Professor Sun says, "I've been locked at my dwelling by the state security team leader, Mr. Li. My wife was threatened to make an announcement that we were traveling. That wasn't true at all. We were not traveling. The police then say, we have our laws and regulations." The VOA reporter says, "What laws and regulations? Does Professor Sun have his freedom? Does he have his civil rights? Does he have rights to speak? Does he have rights to speak?" Then Professor Sun says, "We were taken out of our residence for 10 days and stayed at 4 hotels. Some of the rooms had sealed windows. It was a dark jail. After we were back," he said, "they sent 4 security guys to sleep in our home. I want to thank American senators and House representatives for paying attention. I also want to thank VOA. I started to listen to VOA in 1962. During the Cultural Revolution, they said I was against the revolution. Later, I kept listening to VOA, RFA, and BBC. At this point, authorities in the apartment hallway attempt several times to disrupt the interview. The 2 reporters were then held by police at the building exit." Some security guys started to push and pull Yibing at this point. Yibing said, "Don't try to use force." Security says, "Just come downstairs." And he says, "Can I speak to your supervisor?" Security says, "We could discuss this downstairs." Well, when they got downstairs, security and police started to use force to drag the VOA reporters into a waiting vehicle, and Yibing yelled, "Don't touch me. Where is your leader? We will not move an inch if you try to force us to go. Get your hands off me." The VOA reporters said they were taken in separate vehicles to undisclosed locations on the university campus by men who identified themselves as contract security guards. They were freed before dawn on Tuesday, unharmed. Feng wrote in an email to his editor, "I was just released from the hands of secret police in Jinan with all of my cell phones destroyed by them." He said they separated Alan from me during these hours. "After spending hours in a car with 2 men, I was driven to the outskirts of Jinan and released early Tuesday." He said that the men scanned and downloaded all of his electronic devices before letting him go. VOA's director Amanda Bennett joins us now. And what's been your reaction, and what is your reaction to the detention of these 2 VOA employees?
It's outrageous that 2 journalists are detained by security forces for doing nothing more than their job. It's the job of journalists to find out what's going on, to talk to people in the news, and that is all that they were doing.
Is there any recourse? Where do you lodge protests?
Well, people at the Broadcast Board of Governors, which is our organization, have been reaching out to all the same groups of people that any other journalist would reach out to protest. We've been reaching out to journalistic organizations, both here and in China, to people who are involved in protecting press freedom. We've reached out to the State Department, and we've asked any organization that has any correspondence with China to protest this really appalling event.
What happens to the reaction of an organization like VOA when this type of thing happens? Does a defense go up? Does an attack go up? I mean, how do you react to something like that?
When something like this happens, our first concern, obviously, is the safety of our journalists. So we swing into action to try and make sure that we can determine where the journalists are, whether they've been harmed, and to obviously to get them out of detention. We think that the journalists should be released as soon as possible because it's outrageous that they've been detained.
Has there been a change in the way China has treated VOA journalists over the past year or two that you can see?
We've noticed all around the world that the pressure on journalists has been increasing, and this is not the first time we've had some issues with China and our journalists. So, yes, we've seen a great deal more of these events around the world recently.
Amanda Bennett, VOA Director, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
Happening now in Asia, 9 people are dead, at least 15 others injured as a result of a fire at a hospital in Taipei, Taiwan. The fire broke out on the 7th floor of the building, which was used for hospice care. Media footage showed patients being wheeled out of the building, some still in their hospital beds. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. Beijing has stationed its first permanent search and rescue ship in a hotly disputed part of the South China Sea. Analysts see it as a public relations move after alarming smaller countries with a military buildup in the same waters. The official Xinhua News Agency said the Ministry of Transport in China sent the vessel, called the South Sea Rescue 115, to the Spratly Islands July 27th. The vessel can reportedly work in storm gales and waves up to 6 meters high, and more such vessels are planned to be built. The ministry's Rescue and Salvage Bureau head, Wang Chenliang, was quoted as saying his agency will consistently improve its standby mechanism in the South China Sea region to better carry out maritime rescue duties and obligations under international treaties. Analysts say China may have sent and publicized this vessel's deployment to look good after angering other states over militarization. Coming up, an American muscle car still going strong. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. 3 people were killed, 6 others injured after a signboard fell without warning onto a crowded sidewalk in Shanghai. The sign over a souvenir shop on East Nanjing Road collapsed at night in a popular tourist area near the Bund. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, so does the Ford Mustang. The Ford Motor Company last week produced its 10 millionth two-door sporty Mustang at its Flat Rock, Michigan assembly plant with a celebration including a flyover of World War II Mustang fighters. Its unveiling to the public occurred back in 1964 during the New York's World's Fair and was featured in at least 3 internationally acclaimed movies. It is a nameplate owned in countries around the world. Bob Merlis is a member of the board of the Society of Auto Historians, and he has a website called Feral Cars. He explains to VOA's Victor Beatty the Mustang's durability.
Well, I think the term iconic is overused, but it really is an American icon. And when they screwed up in the 70s and made the Mustang II, which was a Pinto-based car, they knew pretty quickly they had made a mistake. So I guess it's just vox populi, you know, the voice of the people. this is the vehicle they want. They also want a Corvette, but it's not practical because it's just a two-seater. So the Mustang is something a little more utilitarian and a little more accessible.
Is that what causes such popularity?
I think it really struck a chord in the public imagination when it was introduced in 1964 at the World's Fair. I was there. I wasn't there the day they unveiled it, but I was there during the course of the fair and got to ride on the Skyway of Tomorrow, in which all manner of Ford-built vehicles, Lincolns, Mercurys, and Fords, all the convertibles they had were part of it. And it was just a huge competition to get into the Mustang, just to sit in it in what amounts to a little ride. You didn't really drive it, but people just wanted juxtapositions of this car. It just fired the imagination like no other.
This car, of course, appeared in internationally seen movies like Goldfinger, Bullet with Steve McQueen, and a French film called A Man and a Woman. This vehicle has caught on not just in North America, but worldwide.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in A Man and a Woman, and I thought to myself, I saw that movie when it was released. Isn't there a French car or a German car or a British car they could have used? But I think it spoke to the audience that the driver of it was kind of an iconoclast. And it was realistic because the Mustang succeeded the Falcon in the Monte Carlo Rally, mechanically virtually identical, but much more fitting of the role of a performance competition car.
Bob, according to one news source, the Mustangs will soon be only one of two passenger cars from Ford, along with a crossover Focus sold in North America. All other offerings will be trucks and sport utility vehicles. It's still hanging in there, but very few other cars are.
Well, that's true. Ford's move to all truck-based vehicles or crossovers, as contemporary SUVs are known, is a head-scratcher. I understand that people prefer to sit high, etc., but they're deluding themselves as to the real need for such a vehicle. It's quite minimal. A real passenger car, a sedan, is what most people need. And if they want the utility to haul stuff, they really need a minivan. But it's people's self-image projects them into SUVs and trucks.
Mustang lasted 54 years. How many more years do you give it?
I think it could make it to 100. I don't know what cars are going to be like in the future, but It's the nameplate is so important, you can't imagine Ford dispatching it. There will be something in the Ford line called Mustang, I would hazard to suggest, certainly for the duration of my lifetime.
Ford said since it began exporting Mustangs in 2015, it has become the world's best-selling sports coupe, including in China, which is projected to have a car market twice that of the United States by 2025. This news from VOA Asia, North and South Korea have agreed to hold a summit in Pyongyang in September. The agreement to meet was announced during high-level talks between the two Koreas as they seek to implement conditions of the Singapore Summit Declaration signed by President Trump and Kim Jong-un. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, talk about going green. One football team, or soccer if you prefer, has scored its goal to become the first professional sports team in the world to be certified carbon neutral. It's an official designation recently awarded to the team by the Secretary in charge of climate change at the United Nations. But that's not all. The team may also be the world's first 100% vegan football club. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more.
This 2,000-seat soccer stadium is powered entirely by green energy. Forest Green Rovers chairman Dale Vince took over the club 8 years ago with the goal of implementing sustainable solutions.
We've got solar panels on the roof of the stand behind me. We make 20% of all of our electricity here from those panels. The rest we bring in from windmills from around the country.
And that was just the start.
We have an electric kit van. We use electric pool cars. We've got charging points out the front for our fans so they can come to a game, plug in, and get home again. And food, we're vegan, which is the biggest difference anybody can make with their diet.
28-year-old left-back Joseph Mills, who joined the club earlier this summer, says he's often asked about the team's vegan diet.
When you speak to other players from other clubs, they always ask about the vegan side of things and obviously in and around the training ground and the stadium. And with the fans coming to the games, they obviously get to see and taste the food. And from what I've seen and tasted so far, it's been brilliant.
And players have responded well to the plant-based menu, says head chef Jay Crawford.
They said it was really good. They had a lot more energy from it because your body's not taking so long to digest the meat and the dairy products, you know.
On the playing field, the head groundskeeper Adam Witchell has traded the team's gas-powered mower for one that runs on solar. He's especially proud of the team's organic field that he says is 100% pesticide-free.
We use no chemicals and no products that contain animal byproducts. Everything is plant-based. We try and feed the microbes in the soil to help do the work, to help grow the grass. We just drip feed that with things like seaweed, carbohydrates, bacteria and minerals, really.
It's the small things that make a difference, says United Nations' Miguel Naranjo.
Especially with sports organizations, they have such a big visibility, such influence on their whole community, that it's a great opportunity to teach people, to show people, actually, how they can do it also at home.
Based in the town of Nailsworth, with a population of less than 6,000, Forest Green Rovers may be small, but Naranjo says the team is a big inspiration, showing that even the smallest organization can make a big difference. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Here in the United States, businesses have long been preparing for a cashless economy as the use of credit and debit cards instead of cash has become more widespread. But the move towards a cashless economy may have hit a snag in the nation's capital. Some Washington, D.C. council members say the cashless trend has gone too far. And if a new bill introduced by D.C. council member David Grosso passes, some cashless businesses could end up paying real money in the form of big fines. Maria Pruce has the story, narrated by Joy Wagner.
From freshly squeezed juices to fruit smoothies, Drink serves quick and healthy snacks for people in Washington on the go. And no need to fumble through your change, Drink doesn't do cash.
And we use this really handy point of sale app here. We have this handy app that puts all of our products into alphabetical order, and it connects to this handy card reader. So it picks it up, you just slot the card in, and as soon as it's done, they sign and they're on their way.
Cashless payment is convenient for the cafe managers too. There's no need to manually count the day's transactions, and there's little fear of getting robbed, and Drink is not alone.
When I got to a company, it was a surprise to me that they didn't have any cash, that which makes it so much easier for me as a cashier, and I like that idea.
Despite the convenience, such cashless businesses may soon be violating city law. D.C. Council member David Gross believes a cash-only approach discriminates against large segments of the city's population that operate only with cash. He says businesses that don't allow people to pay in cash should be penalized.
Nearly 30% of the District of Columbia residents are unbanked or underbanked, meaning that they don't have a bank account at all. So when you cut out their options for eating by saying you must have a credit card, I think that's unfair, and I think we should try to stop it.
Grosso advises businesses to get safes to store their cash, and he says those that refuse to take cash in payments should be forced to pay a fine. Grosso says $8,000 would be fair, and he has supporters.
I think the problem with cash, because I've experienced this, a lot of people, younger especially, do not know how to make change.
According to credit card processor TSYS, only about 12% of Americans prefer cash to cards. But the International Currency Association thinks differently. Their data shows the use of cash rising since 2012, even as electronic transactions gain traction.
What if the systems break down? Visa recently had a glitch in Europe, and people were unable to make payments for several hours. The same recently happened to MasterCard.
Today, only businesses in the state of Massachusetts are legally obligated to take cash. Washington may be next. But proponents of a cashless society say it's a step backwards and could mean financial losses for businesses that specialize only in electronic transactions. I'm Joy Wagner for Maria Pruce, Dmitry Savchuk, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find our program free of charge each and every day on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. For those of you listening in Myanmar, we thank you for joining us on Facebook through VOA Burmese, and everyone who's listened to our program today, no matter where in the world you may be. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and of course, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.